The first case on our calendar is 05-428, State of Ohio versus Roy Durham, Jr. Ms. Skutnik.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Carol Skutnik, and I represent the State of Ohio in this matter. I would respectfully like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Thank you. It's the position of the State of Ohio in this matter that the trial court did properly evaluate the testimony of Dr. Ezzo and conclude that the statements which were made to Dr. Ezzo were not made for purposes of treatment and diagnosis. And therefore, the proper foundation had not been laid for him to testify as to the victim's statements to him during the course of what he characterized as his brief interactional appointment.
Counsel, what was the purpose of the child's interaction with Dr. Ezzo?
The mother of the child had filed a petition. There was a petition for visitation which was pending in juvenile court. Dr. Ezzo, as a psychologist employed in the diagnostic clinic of juvenile court, was asked to evaluate the mother of the victim, the defendant, biological father of the victim, and the defendant's mother, because it was the defendant's mother who was seeking what she deemed grandparents' rights or visitation rights with the child. The psychologist, Dr. Ezzo, was not ordered by the court to see the victim in this case. He testified in the brief foundational testimony that he laid out before the trial court that he had an opportunity to perform a brief interactional appointment with the victim where he had an opportunity to observe the victim absent the parents being present.
And counsel, was the juvenile court's purpose for bringing in Dr. Ezzo based on the allegations the child had made against the grandmother?
It is not clear from the record and the evidence, it's not clear from the transcript that is in fact what his purpose was in being called in. That foundation was not laid.
But that was before the juvenile court, the allegation, knowing that the child had previously alleged that the grandmother was involved in a sexual assault.
That is correct, Your Honor. In 2001, the child had indicated to his parent, and his parent then conveyed through a petition to juvenile court that he had made allegations against his father and his grandmother.
But let me ask you then, what is the distinction, what difference are you drawing between the revelations the child made to a social worker as opposed to Dr. Ezzo? How are they different when the social worker's testimony, not in this case, but in other cases, is permissible, where this is not?
I'd like to be clear that it is not the position of the State of Ohio that statements made by a child to a social worker do not fall under the treatment and medical diagnosis category or exception to the hearsay rule. That is not my position whatsoever. My position in this case is that the proponent of the testimony, that being the defendant and his counsel, did not lay the proper foundation for this testimony to come in. I believe that based upon the analysis of the Dever case and the subsequent cases that have analyzed social worker testimony, that social worker testimony, psychologist testimony, other mental health professionals can testify under the statements made for purposes of treatment and diagnosis if the proper foundation is laid. And that is the key issue in this case, that in this case, they merely indicated what his background, Dr. Ezzo's background training and education was, what his employment with juvenile court was. From there, Dr. Ezzo indicated that he was asked to interview those three individuals I've earlier named, and that he had a brief interactional appointment with the victim in this case. He did not indicate or lay any foundation in this case as to the environment in which this child was interviewed, as to any conversation that he had with this child, as to his purpose
for this
interview. Well,
he didn't get to testify, did he?
Actually, he did get an opportunity to testify as to all of the foundational requirements. It was at the point in which he wanted to testify to what the victim said to him.
That was in front of the jury?
That was in front of the jury.
Right.
So he came in and he talked about those things that I've just outlined. He was asked those series of questions. He was not asked, and there was no foundation before being asked about the victim's statements, about those very key and important things. The environment in which the statement was made, the preliminary discussion
were you the trial counsel?
I was, Your Honor.
Did you make it clear the basis of your objection so that the defense attorney could remedy that?
I would submit to this court as an officer of this court that I did make such an objection and did carefully indicate why I was objecting at the sidebar. The transcript was not, the record was not at the sidebar at the time, so the transcript does not reflect that. The transcript merely reflects the trial court's indicating why the objection was levied and why the objection was sustained and under what exceptions the defense counsel had tried to offer such testimony.
Why wouldn't those objections really go more towards the credibility of his testimony? Did he have the proper questions, the proper setting, and all that goes to really the credibility of the doctor's testimony and the statements he elicited?
My response to that begins by going back to the Dever decision and this court's discussion in the Dever case. The emphasis, the original discussion in the Boston case as to the motivational requirement. In the state of Ohio versus Dever, it was a medical doctor. And this court talked about that the strict motivational standard did not apply in a child's case, but it did not do away with the motivation of the declarant. And that is still a proper factor in analyzing whether or not this is reliable testimony.
So you're not really objecting that this was for diagnosis and treatment. You're just objecting as to how the foundation was laid?
It is my position that this witness was not diagnosing nor treating this child, and that is clear from his testimony and the purpose in meeting with him. But I am also indicating that the court properly excluded the testimony because there was no foundation laid in furtherance or to further support their contention that it was diagnosis and treatment.
Why wouldn't this be diagnosis? Let's put treatment aside, because we have a case coming up in the next session where the state's taking the opposite position you're taking and arguing to get testimony in, saying that while they didn't treat, they were at least diagnosing on behalf of the law enforcement request. Whatever we do in this case may affect the state in the next case, and so we have to be very careful of that.
And I agree with that, and I would certainly concede that these cases really turn on a factual or a close analysis of the facts in the case. I shudder to think that Dr. Ezzo was diagnosing this child based upon a very brief appointment where there was no testing, there was no extensive interview with the child, no background, no review of prior records, no history provided to him, none of those things that would be a necessary predicate.
Okay, let's accept then your argument, sake of this argument, that there's no diagnosis or treatment. Why, at the very least, should this not come in as a prior and consistent statement? And it goes to the very heart of the issue of whether or not this child was molested. You have an absolute denial to a medical professional that it did not happen. Why is it excluded on that basis? I'm having a difficult time, even if you accept your medical diagnosis treatment argument, why is it not a statement against interest?
When you look at the analysis under Rule 613B, which the 8th District Appellate Court did not conduct such an analysis, I would first, of course, remind the court that the defense counsel did not submit this statement as a prior inconsistent statement. He only argued present sense impression, which clearly didn't apply, and treatment for medical diagnosis, statements for treatment and medical diagnosis, I'm sorry. So when we look at whether or not there is plain error, I would submit the following things to this court. This child disclosed in 2001, or indicated in 2001, that it was his father and his grandmother that had been sexually abusing him. In 2003, he's seeing a doctor at the juvenile court. The testimony was that this child was told by his father, not only that the father engaged in a pattern of intimidation of this child and inducing fear in this child, but most importantly, told this child that if he ever told anybody what he was doing, that he would go to jail. The disclosure comes that he's being anally molested in June of 2003. So approximately 5 or 6 months earlier, he's taken to juvenile court, where juveniles go who are being prosecuted or under claims that they are delinquent. He had not told anybody at that point about the recent conduct that his father had engaged in with him, that he was keeping it a secret out of fear. Fear as well as
But don't all those go to the credibility? I mean, isn't all of that admissible to a jury to explain that why he may have been inconsistent, why he may have told different stories? It seems to me you're giving the jury only one side of the picture and not the full picture with all the facts of the alleged threats and fear and intimidation that might explain it. And so all they're hearing is one version. It seems to me that that's difficult for a jury to make an accurate assessment when they don't have all those other facts before them.
Respectfully, the question before the court is whether or not the outcome of the trial would have been different. And when the court looks at the all of the facts in this case, I don't believe that this court could say that the outcome would have been different. On several occasions, there were instances where this child was specifically questioned about facts that were later introduced in evidence. For example, he claimed that he had not made an allegation against his grandmother in 2001, that his grandmother had never touched him, whereas there was several instances of testimony that in fact, had happened. The jury heard a number of inconsistencies in his testimony, and I have great respect for the jury's verdict and the fact that they analyzed his description of these particular events in spite of the numerous times at which his credibility was attacked. But I think looking at the timeline of events.
But counsel, getting to that point, if the jury heard that there was inconsistencies in his revelation of the activity with his paternal grandmother, they didn't hear that with regards to the father, and the father was the one on trial, not the paternal grandmother. And they heard no inconsistencies with regard to the child's statements about the father, when in fact there were inconsistencies there.
Well, I would submit two things in response to that. One is, again, looking at the situation in which he meets this unknown man, this strange individual at juvenile court. He doesn't even remember meeting this individual at juvenile court by the time that he testifies.
And this child was 7 years old when he's testifying, correct?
That is correct.
All right, so we put this in the perspective of something happening to a child when he's 6 and 7 years old.
He would have been 6 years old and then a couple months into his seventh year when he discloses.
Okay.
But I think it's very important to look at the environment in which he's interviewed and the statement of Dr. Ezzo. I asked him if he was molested by his father and his grandmother, and he denied it. When you compare that with the testimony that there was no visitation in 2002, that this occurs before June, this statement occurs before June.
Counsel, I understand that you're arguing the validity of the statement, but you had ample opportunity to cross-examine this doctor if he was allowed to testify to these facts.
That is correct. And unfortunately, it was not submitted as a prior inconsistent statement, and so neither the trial court at that time was not aware of that.
So if it was a prior inconsistent statement as the basis for the introduction, the state would have been silent as to objections?
No. I further submitted, as I did at the appellate court level, that asking a child in two questions. Did you ever go to juvenile court? Did you ever talk to Dr. Ezzo and tell him this didn't happen? It's an insufficient foundation for a prior inconsistent statement when you're talking about a 7-year-old child in an appointment that had occurred approximately 1 year earlier. At that time, I would have asked for further, I would have objected as improper or insufficient foundational requirements to address that, to have him come in and talk about this statement.
Counsel, what was the purpose of the criminal rules?
To govern the proceedings in a criminal trial.
And to assist in achieving justice, is it not?
Justice is of course, the ultimate objective.
Okay. But here, you're prosecuting someone and seeking a life sentence, right?
Life sentence with parole eligibility
and
10 years.
And you use the criminal rules to keep that individual from having any of the information that would indicate that he could be innocent from getting to the jury.
This court indicates any information that would allowed the trial court to
well,
to
you didn't want him to hear about the police officer that he went to voluntarily right away and denied it, right?
Because it is not admissible under the rules of evidence.
Right. Well, you've got a reason for everything.
And that's my position ultimately before this court and any other court, that the proponent of the evidence has to abide by the law, abide by the rules of evidence, and abide by the requisite foundational requirements, just as I do, and just, for example, as I did with Dr. Wagstaff, and I expect no different or no other from the defense counsel in this case or the courts that analyze this case.
Counsel, another question I have is there's reference, I believe, in the opinion, appellate opinion, to the polygraph. Was that a polygraph that was done without the state's participation?
That is correct, and that was the basis of...
But it was done by the police?
It was done by the police without the knowledge of the state of Ohio, to wit, the prosecution. In fact, it wasn't brought to my attention until prior to trial. It was not done as a joint measure as under Ohio law.
It wasn't a stipulated polygraph here.
Precisely.
And the state, even though this was conducted by a police officer, would not, after the fact, stipulate to its validity?
No.
Why not?
Well, the state did not enter into that agreement. The state did not participate in that.
Did you find something flawed with the process?
Unfortunately, I didn't have time to examine the process under which it was done when it finally came to my attention, which was shortly before trial.
Ms. Skutnik, I have what would usually be a threshold question. I've saved it because I listened to the argument. As you know, I did not vote to allow this case for review in the merits because I did not see a principle of law that needed to be clarified or addressed. And in your two propositions of law, those really are error propositions. What principle of law can we write in this case that the entire argument, with all due respect, the entire discussion here has been like an oral argument in a court of appeals. It's error correction. What principle of law would you suggest we can write in this case that can clarify or can assist judges and lawyers in trying these cases in the future?
This court in State versus Dever outlined a set of principles which I believe predominantly apply to medical professionals. It has been extended at the appellate court level to refer to mental health professionals and social workers, et cetera. But I believe that there is certainly room for abuse when it is extended beyond certain thresholds, and that there are threshold requirements that you still have to look at the initial reliability of the statement, and you still have to have foundational requirements when we're dealing with mental health professionals.
But that's not new law, is it? Is that something new?
I believe that it is an extension of a principle into a new area. It is a clarification of a principle in a new area, not unlike when this court addressed the medical profession in the State versus Dever case. I believe that it is very useful and to allow or extend the exception to mental health professionals, social workers, et cetera. But again, I think it is necessary for this court to define what type of foundation is required in order for that testimony to come in, appreciating the analysis in child abuse cases, the volume of child abuse cases, and obviously the critical issue contained therein, no different than the issues examined in State versus Dever.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gladman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Gladman. I am counsel for the appellee, Mr. Roy Durham. The Court of Appeals correctly relied upon two independent bases for determining that the trial court was wrong to exclude the testimony of Dr. Izzo. First, as this court set forth in State v. Dever, absent extraordinary circumstances, a child's statements regarding alleged sexual abuse are presumed to be motivated by a desire for treatment or diagnosis. And second, the child's statements to Dr. Izzo flatly contradicted his trial testimony, and therefore, the statement should also have been admitted as a 613B prior and consistent statement. Now, in State v. Dever, this court set forth two factors that need to be considered when we're faced with these types of statements. The first is, were the child's statements motivated by a desire for diagnosis or treatment? And in Boston, 3 years before, this court had held that 8034 would rarely apply to such sort of statements because of perceived lack of that motivation. But in Dever, 3 years later, this court concluded that the Boston framework had been wrong, that this was a special type of circumstances requiring a rebuttable presumption that, in fact, child statements about allegations of sexual abuse are indeed motivated by a desire to be truthful because of the desire for diagnosis and treatment. In fact, the court concluded that, absent extraordinary circumstances, that motivation is present. Now, to be sure, the presumption can be overcome upon a showing that there was inappropriate influence upon the child. And I think the Dever court set forth a couple examples, evidence of leading questions or a third party being present with a medical caregiver that might have inappropriately influenced the child to saying one thing or another. But the court was very clear. Absent such a showing, the court said, it is permissible to assume that the factors underlying 8034 are present. Now, the state comes to this court today and asks, to be certain, they ask that this court reject the Dever analysis that has stood for almost 14 years. They want proof of motivation of the child to be seeking treatment or diagnosis. But that's really reminiscent of the rejected Boston analysis that they're asking the court to return to. The irony, of course, is that the case law, including Dever, has developed in an effort to assist prosecution of these types of very crimes. And this is a situation where it's turned around and it's bitten the prosecution in a way that's not normally associated with the application of this rule. In fact, it helped the prosecution, it being 8034, helped the prosecution in this very case because it allowed in the testimony of Dr. Wagstaff, who the child also made statements to. So the state likes it when it can be used to their benefit, but they don't like the rule when it can be used against them. Of course, there are negative implications to future prosecutions. I gotta believe that the state is being a little bit short-sighted here today when they're arguing for anybody who's a proponent of such type of evidence has to show proof. They call it laying a foundation, but they're really asking for, in their brief, proof of the fact that the child had these types of motivations to be truthful. And in fact, that's gonna impact their prosecutions more than it's gonna impact defense counsel.
So is it your view that this case is one which involves the credibility of a witness, as Justice Stratton asked the prosecution?
I certainly believe that that is part of the analysis here. In State v. Dever, the court even said that, you know, this does not take care of or put the ball in front of the jury without some limitations on it. And the court specifically referred to the fact that both the medical caregiver would be subject to cross-examination on the circumstances surrounding it, and if the child in fact testified, as was the case here, he is also subject to cross-examination.
Well, then, if this is a case that involves the credibility of a victim witness in a criminal prosecution, how would you answer the Chief Justice's question, what is the rule of law the new rule that, that should be written in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully submit that there is no rule, new rule of law to be written here, that the rule of law is Deaver, that we have a rebuttable presumption that this sort of statement made to a medical professional is in fact presumed to be motivated by a desire for treatment or diagnosis. There's an extra step that the court just said it's a safeguard of that rebuttable presumption, and that the child, or I'm sorry, the medical caregiver is still subject to the cross-examination. Lower courts have also relied upon this Deaver presumption, including Schulte and Sinclair as set forth in the brief. And here, there is no evidence whatsoever that the statements to Dr. Izzo were inappropriately influenced in any way. Indeed, the presumption is actually consistent with the evidence that was submitted at trial about this child and what he understood he was supposed to do when he saw a doctor. There was testimony that the child understood he had to be truthful when he saw doctors in order to get better. He also had extensive experience, unfortunately, dealing with psychologists, therapists, and counselors. This was not a child who walked into an environment and said, "What is this person who's not wearing a white coat?" He was familiar with this sort of environment. Therefore, the motivational factor is deemed to be present under the Deaver presumption. Now, Deaver makes clear that this motivational analysis is indeed the primary consideration when doing an 8034 inquiry. But the court also stated that you can look for further support for the admissibility if, in fact, the caregiver relied upon the statements for purposes of diagnosis or treatment. And here, Dr. Izzo relied upon the child's statements in fulfilling his statutory obligations to help make a determination of what was in the best interest of this child. There's no dispute that 8034 applies both to diagnosis as well as treatment. And just because Dr. Izzo himself said, "I did not treat this child," that's not the end of the inquiry. The trial court did not make any analysis whatsoever, ask any questions about whether or not this could have been a diagnostic process. They just said no treatment, not admissible. Indeed, Dr. Izzo himself said that, in fact, he evaluated the child, and I would submit that's the functional equivalent of doing a diagnostic process. And under 310904, the custody and visitation provision, which was at issue with Dr. Izzo being involved, in fact, the process is set up where there is an evaluation meeting, such as we had here where the child made statements. Dr. Izzo submitted a report, which he diagnoses the child's best interest. It makes a recommendation to the court as what's in the child's best interest. And then we have an ultimate determination of where the child should live. And that is the functional equivalent of treatment. And that's not me just saying that logically. Lower courts like Schulte and Presley, as I set forth in the brief, agree that the process by which a custody or a visitation determination is made indeed qualify as treatment under 8034. Moreover, Deaver itself supports this interpretation of the rule because it adopted in part the reasoning of United States v. Renville, an Eighth Circuit, 1985 opinion, where the Eighth Circuit said that these types of statements about allegations of sexual abuse, including the identity of the perpetrator, are the very type of statements that medical professionals rely upon, including in making determinations where the child is going to be safe and where the child should be lived. This is precisely the same process that Dr. Izzo was involved in. He had a statutory obligation to consider these factors, and it's ludicrous to suggest that a child telling yes or no, I was or was not sexually abused, would not be important to Dr. Izzo in making his recommendations to the juvenile court.
Mr. Gladman, do you think that, I mean, Deaver is written very broadly, and courts of appeals have followed it in individual cases, but do you think that we should review 803 and the section that's in question 4 with an eye to clarifying? I mean, it seems to me that the words of 803 are quite specific, and they're fairly limiting. I think Deaver went a little beyond the words of 803. Would it be helpful to the bar, and I'll give Ms. Skutnik a chance to respond also to the question, should we be reviewing 803 to determine whether we can make it more precise and give more guidance so we don't have this constant churning in the trial courts and courts of appeals on this issue?
Yeah, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think Deaver is very clear in that the most important factor that a court needs to consider is this motivational component. And it clearly sets forth that there's a rebuttable presumption that if a child is making these very kind of specific statements relating to allegations of sexual abuse and who is involved, in fact, that we're going to apply some special rules under 8034. It's relatively narrow in its scope in that regard. And then it goes on to say that a trial court can conduct an inquiry, The party opposing admissibility can submit evidence showing that there's some sort of inappropriate influence. But absent such a showing, the presumption is there that the motivation was there. And I think that's very clear from that opinion, and I think it's very functional.
Well, from the opinion, but not from the rule. The rule says nothing about motivation, does it? It's a pretty stark rule, frankly.
It is a stark rule, but I can also suggest, Your Honor, that the federal version of the rule, which is identical, I believe, to the Ohio version of the rule, there are case law is replete with the basic notion that the underpinnings of this hearsay exception, as most hearsay exceptions are, is the fact that there's a motivation for the declarant to be truthful. If someone is dying, they have an incentive to be truthful. If they're seeing a doctor, they have an incentive to be truthful. Now, Deaver clearly set forth that it's a tougher situation when a child's involved because these rules are developed to help with adult situations. But the court was very clear in saying that this is a special type of circumstance when these children make these types of allegations. And again, the rule developed, understandably, to assist in prosecutions which otherwise might not be allowed to go forward. Again, the state benefits from this rule 99.9% of the time. This time, they're not benefiting from it, and they don't like it. Now, I will point to the rule itself and say it does fit this situation because this child was asked about the cause of symptoms, pains, or sensations that he had previously alleged. Therefore, it falls within the language of the rule. I'd also like to briefly talk about the 613B issue, if I may. The statement that Mr. Durham never sexually abused his child that was made by this child to Dr. Izzo should have been admitted as a prior and consistent statement. There's no dispute that this child's statement to Dr. Izzo contradicted his later trial testimony. And under 613B, the extrinsic evidence of that prior and consistent statement is admissible under certain circumstances. I note that the state has said that the Court of Appeals did not go through the specific analysis. I would suggest two responses to that. Their brief did not, and I did not hear them addressing those today. Moreover, I believe that they are so obviously met here that that's why the state continues to focus upon the plain error standard, but I would like to address them very briefly. Two-part requirement under 613B. The first part has three subparts. Has to be offered for impeachment. It was. The witness has to be given an opportunity to explain the statement. He was. He was asked about it. The side opposing the admissibility of the evidence has to have an opportunity to examine the witness as well. The state did. All three are met. The second is the subject matter of the statement at issue has to be a fact that is of consequence to the proceeding. Here, as I set forth in my brief, it is the fact of consequence, whether or not the crime was committed.
Mr. Gladman, was the testimony offered as a prior inconsistent statement after the court determined that 803.4 was not going to apply?
It was not, Your Honor. It's my understanding that trial counsel, after the 803.4, I believe was jointly actually, also suggested that perhaps this could come in under a present sense impression exception, which we're not arguing about here today. So it's true that the objection was not levied at trial, that this should be admitted under the 613B exception. But as this court set forth in State v. Barnes, and consistent with Criminal Rule 52B, in fact, plain error such as this can be recognized by courts of appeals and corrected. You have to just have a deviation from a legal rule that results in an obvious defect in the trial proceedings, and of course, most importantly, as the state focuses, you have to have an effect on the outcome of the trial. Here I'd submit that it's plainly obvious that all of these are true. The outcome of the trial was impacted by the failure of the trial court to admit the child's statements that Mr. Durham did not commit the very crimes of which he was accused. And most significantly, what was lost in the state's description of this issue was that there was no other testimony. I mean, this conviction rests upon this 7-year-old child's testimony against this defendant. There's no physical evidence. There's nothing but this. There's no other witnesses. So to suggest that the outcome of the trial was not affected by a statement that seriously undermines the credibility of the sole witness against the defendant, I think is hard to accept. I'd like to also point out that the state continues to try to downplay the significance of the statements that the child made to Dr. Izzo by being a little bit unclear. I won't say distorting, but they're not clear about the timing of the statements in issue, and I'd like to set it forth very, very briefly. There's three key dates here. The state says that this abuse happened between June of 2000 and December of 2002. That's in the indictment as well as statements of the prosecutor at trial. The statements that the child made to Dr. Izzo that nothing ever happened with the father or the grandmother occurred in February 2003. And then in June 2003, the child supposedly went to his mother and said, this abuse happened, which the state has pinned as occurring between 2000 and 2002. The state's brief talks about, you know, the disclosure of abuse occurring in June 2003, and I think that's a little misleading. And yet again, this morning I heard that the child was, quote, being molested in June 2003. That's just flat wrong. I want to be very clear that there is no allegation of abuse. There was no evidence in the record that any abuse ever occurred after the period of June 2000 to June 2003. So therefore, the statement in February of 2003, after the allegations of abuse occurred, clearly has an impact on the outcome of the trial. In sum, this jury had to believe, in fact, this child in order to convict Mr. Durham, and his inconsistent statement would have undermined the credibility and would have affected the outcome of the trial. And for all those reasons, we would ask that the Court of Appeals decision be affirmed, and we have a new trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gladman. Ms. Gutnick, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds. And I'll start you off. As promised, I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Gladman about Rule 803. Should the court review that rule with the objective of making it more clear?
It is my position that the court should review that rule of evidence as it pertains to mental health professionals and clarify the foundational requirements for those statements, just as it analyzed in State versus Dever as it related to medical professionals. I would submit that the foundational requirements are still the same. There is a benefit in the medical field because you have a child walking into a doctor's office, a place that he has probably frequented a number of times since birth, as in Dever, and certainly as in this case with Dr. Wagstaff, where he had been treated by him for 5 years. Appellee takes great liberty at saying this child had seen a number of mental health professionals. The difference is that he saw them in environments such as a community center, the Mertis Taylor Medical Center, and another doctor that he had a longstanding relationship with. It is the position of the state of Ohio here, not that 803.04 does not apply to psychologists, mental health professionals, or social workers. It is the position of the state of Ohio that there was no foundation laid in this case to establish that the victim in this case understood who he was talking to, why he was talking to, and why it was important for him to be truthful in his statements, particularly at a time when he was still under a great deal of fear.
Counsel, could you address the question of plain error on the second proposition of law that how is it not plain error?
Your Honor, it's our position that it cannot be said that but for this statement, the outcome of the trial would have been otherwise. And that is because the child himself testified as to why he did not tell anybody what was going on with him, why he had withheld this information, and why he didn't ultimately reveal it until the point in time of June of 03.
You really believe that?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. I do believe, and in working with this victim and working in this field, I place a great deal of credibility in that statement that children, why children reveal at a point in time when they do, why they don't reveal after they're being abused year after year after year.
Let me ask you about the polygraph that Justice O'Connor asked about and is referred to, and the Court of Appeals makes it appear that this gentleman agreed to submit to the polygraph at the suggestion of the police officer that initially interviewed him, and that he voluntarily did that. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So it wasn't his idea. It was the police officer who initially interviewed him who set this up and had a state highway patrolman conduct it. And you reject that as any indication of this man's innocence?
I'll be very frank with this court that I cannot recall if it was the statement of the defendant, I'll take a polygraph, which was then set up, or if it was the statement of the police officer at this time.
But it was done in that environment. It was
done by the police officer during the initial investigation.
So he doesn't have a lawyer there or anything else doing this at this point?
Correct. And do I think that that's an indication of innocence? Well, I would merely submit to this court that if a polygraph examination was the end-all, be-all, then we wouldn't have such a stringent set of rules as to when it is admissible and requirements as to agreements between parties.
I'm not suggesting that, but it does play into a thing we call prosecutorial discretion, does it not, in evaluating these cases and deciding whether or not to go forward?
It is certainly a relevant inquiry, and it was, and it did exist in this case. But I would submit to this court, when you look at the description of this child and his use of all of the senses, that it was overwhelming and compelling and overcame this issue of whether or not the defendant was asked to take a polygraph test or whether or not he passed a polygraph test.
Thank you, Ms. Gutnick.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.